Before we get started, I think it's prudent for us to talk a little bit as this is our first episode. So the real purpose of the show is to bring forth the unknown possibilities from the realm of the unknown into the known. And by that, I mean simply that when you know something, when you truly know something, when you believe you know something, you don't open yourself up to the other possibilities that may be, so that there's a lot of opportunity for us to solve common problems in society and the world around us, and we don't consider them because we're so focused on one way of being, one mode, one method. Peter, you know, I mean, it is something that you and I have talked about, you know, obviously for years.
Quite a bit.
So I'm excited. I mean, I'm very excited to be here, obviously, and to discuss this topic, because I think it's a critical component to the future of not just our society, but honestly, all societies that find themselves in the state that we have found ourselves in today.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a very pivotal moment, at least in U.S. history. And I imagine other countries throughout the world are going through the same sort of thing, where we've had two going on almost 3 years now of the pandemic that has affected society at all levels, and I think in a lot of unexpected fashions. And probably the most profound has been the impact on the children and young people as they're as they went through this, because the routine, the expected cadence of day-to-day life just got shot. So it's one thing if you're talking teenagers, young adults in college, right? They're mature, capable, have relatively well-formed personalities, even though they still may be evolving, and they could more easily cope with this. They're more flexible, given the nature of their maturity. The impact on school age, elementary school children, I think is only really starting to be understood. Daniel, you and I privately have talked about this quite a bit. And coincidentally, I caught up with some old friends who I hadn't seen in a while, and who have school age children.
Right.
And independently, they all noted that the academic impacts were noticeable but manageable. It's the psychological and developmental impacts on their children that aren't being adequately discussed at a broader level. Individual teachers are on the ball. They know what's going on and they're trying their best, at least the ones who are engaged and interested. But this hasn't percolated up to the broader society, I don't think. And when it has, it has been in a very nasty partisan manner, which comes from the inherent politicization of the education system, at least in the U.S. as it's evolved over, say, the last 30, 40 years. There's a slight age difference between us, which, we know, but nobody else
does. Sure.
But I think that even that slight age difference shows the generational differences that we experienced, again, elementary, high school level and beyond. And I think it's even more profound when we compare our experiences with what young parents are going through now, late 20s, maybe early 30s, 5-6-year-old kid just entering the school system for real. And I think we have to dig into this and kind of share some of the experiences and that we have had, as well as other parents. And I think it's worth mentioning that we intentionally pick this subject as the first topic in what will hopefully be a long series of podcasts, because this is foundational to everything that comes in society. If you have an uneducated populace, you have a devastated society at the end of the day. If you don't get education right, at least at the primary, secondary level, you're doomed and going forward in terms of human evolution. So this is something that's very dear to both of us, and I think other people as well.
Now, I think it has to be. It absolutely has to be, because if you can look at a history book and you can understand that, and you can look forward, I mean, we're dealing with more. The stakes are different now. The stakes are different because the rate of technological change is so drastically different than it has at pretty much any other point in history.
Yeah.
So what does that do? It enables us to see everything that's going on around us. And to an extent, and some people can certainly suffer because of that. And I mean this like at a psychological basis, because, and we touched on this with the children. I have two school age children, and they did remote learning for most of the COVID year there, late in spring of last year and into 2020. And, you know, we're fortunate that they have that opportunity. And I realize that a lot of people do not have that flexibility. My, you know, I'm fortunate. I have a lovely wife. She was able to make sure that she kept them on a schedule, on a routine. Yeah. And because she's able to do that, it helped them to know psychologically that, you know, it's different. Yeah, it's different and it's stable. That's key, stability, right? Because that's what school age children need. That's what people in general need. Let's be honest. Okay.
Yeah. So, but not to belittle the point.
Yeah.
For children, routine and predictability is key because it gives them a sense of safety. And if they're safe, they're going to be in a good psychological space. They'll learn, they'll flourish, they'll thorough. They'll get the most that they can out of anything they do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a, to the point that you made earlier, this is not something that's small because we don't know the effects of this. We will not know the effects of this until we look back 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. And even someone astute will have to be doing that. People that actually care, that want to drive truth from the matter, not without a political agenda, as we were previously discussing. I really, you know, it's that's something we have to take up as a completely another series, because obviously we're not getting anywhere with the way that it's happening right now. But
well, to kind of loop back to your point about how the pace of technology has impacted everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think exactly this topic is the most germane example of how that rapid technological advance affects things, right?
Yes.
For the first time, parents were able to see actually what was going on in their children's classrooms, not what they thought it was, not what was going on when they were in school 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago.
Right? Yes.
And I think there was a very hard, rude, and rapid awakening of the unequal way in which different school systems, different schools, different teachers responded, so that we got to see a very different view of the real state of the educational system in the country than what has been popularly portrayed. As an example, you know, I do pretty well economically. I was able to have both my kids in private school, right?
Right.
At the time, my daughter was finishing high school. My son is in his junior year right now.
Right.
Their schools said, okay, this is a mess. Give us a week. We'll figure something out. And the kids will be back in on learning. True to their word, they did. So very happy, but I'm paying for it out of pocket. So it was expected. And I guarantee you that all the other parents said something to the effect, to the credit of the schools and the teachers, they responded. That's great. The town in which I live had a completely opposite response. And we are not in a particularly upscale town. We're very middle-class type town. It took the teachers months to figure out what to do. Literally months. So I would see these poor kids walking around the neighborhood, not in any malicious way, but just as some way to occupy their time because they were unable to have their classroom situation addressed by the town school system.
Right.
I live in Massachusetts. Boston school system, very large, admittedly, lots of different problems at all levels, the whole bit. Different scale of operations, took them much longer to figure things out. And it degenerated into a lot of needless bickering, in my own opinion. Okay, so now by virtue of what town you happen to live in, you had a completely different response based on whether you're public versus private, small town versus large city. And all of a sudden, people started asking, well, if this guy can figure it out at this school and this headmaster and this teacher all get it squared away, why can't these people over in the larger cities do likewise? Which is a very valid question. And rather than address it to say, you know, whatever the case may be, there was a lot of hand waving and, in my opinion, needless finger pointing going back and forth. Great. We have now identified a fundamental flaw in how education is delivered to our children. We're past the worst of the pandemic. We're coming out of it. There's still no discussion of the plan of, hey, what did we learn and what are we going to do going forward to leverage these things to improve the experience overall for all kids at all levels. And along those lines, again, speaking to the gap that you mentioned between technological access and the whole bit, right?
Yes.
Legitimately, there's a lot of kids out there who do not have the benefit of your lovely wife stay at home to keep them on the straight and narrow because they had to work legitimately, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Families, absolutely. Right?
So, gee, I use the truck driver as the proverbial metaphor because, you know, blue collar background, these are the kind of people that I grew up around, find decent, good people, but they didn't have a ton of dough. I didn't go to private school. I went to public school, right?
Yeah.
So is it fair that the truck driver who's making, you know, 40, 50,000 an hour or a year delivering stuff, that his children do not have equal access because he can't afford to go buy them laptops and webcams and have internet access and the whole thing? That that rapidly starts adding to the bill. Okay,
oh, absolutely.
What are you guys going to do about it as a government to serve your constituents? Nothing. And, you know, Daniel, both you and I are in the technology business.
Yes.
We know how this could have been addressed really without that much money. But, okay, federal government releases CARES money. What happened to it? A lot of towns took it, sat on it, have done nothing with it to date. This is a fact. They'll dispute it. You and I both responded to RFPs for these things and know that they all went nowhere because nobody wanted to pull the trigger on actually executing against anything. So, again, who suffers? You and I know. We just move on to the next client. We don't care.
Right.
But the children of the constituents in these towns suffer because the administration was incapable of acting rapidly and leveraging resources that were, in fact, available to them to meet the needs and to move forward and to elevate the game for everybody, not just the poorest of the poor or the richest of the rich. This would have helped everybody across the board were it implemented strategically at a high level with thought about what the impact would be. And I know I kind of went on a tangent, but
I think it's important to really flesh out the problem here, right? Because it's at multiple levels. It's not just that there's an identified problem with the ability to deliver or respond to a particular incident or pandemic or whatever it may be, right? I mean, just for context, we're at public school, Wisconsin, not Boston, fairly affluent area. It took them about a week to get everybody online, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody's using Google Classroom, Google Meet, and everything set up, you know, and they had some structure and they made it better over time. But this goes to another thought. I mean, this is again, it's a pretty nice area. And the schools, even though it's public, like it's rated very highly in the state, like 99th percentile. Okay. So you and I know it draws a certain type of person there. They have a certain structure, they operate in a certain way. There's accountability there. There's accountability from the parents, mm-hmm. even though it's a public school, people are heavily involved.
Right.
In the school. I mean, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of donations that happen there. And it's nice. It's nice for that. But the real problem there is that if there was a good template for how to respond, for how to enable learning, for how to get kids the education that they need, to get them the structure that they need, that the schooling essentially is providing, you know, if it's working well in a few ways, we need to be sharing that.
And I think that's key. That did not happen.
Exactly.
That did not happen.
Yes.
And this goes to the legacy, I think, of the fact that we're still running education in the United States of America on a 19th century mindset, when in fact, we're trying to prepare our young people for the 21st century and beyond. And stuff that may have worked in 1950 mm-hmm. is not going to work in 2022, much less 2030, 2040, and beyond, right?
Yes.
So all of this stuff was going on. Individual schools figured it out. Why was this not shared with other schools within a system? Or if a particular school system figured it out, why was it not shared with other school systems? And I'm quite sure we would have a large amount of people saying, well, that's not true. That happened. I vehemently disagree with that, because I was involved directly with some of these schools on trying to get this stuff going. And the amount of infighting, petty territorial pissing, you know, for lack of a better phrase, mm-hmm. was staggering to me. And especially when I went and I, you know, started to try to help volunteer on certain basis and see, okay, what's going on? You know, well, we can't support this in our school. Why? Well, we're having trouble. You look into it, you see equipment that hasn't been touched in literally 25 years, right? from companies that no longer exist.
Yeah.
Using it. Right. And, you know, my immediate question was, what did you guys do with all the money that you got for technology in the classroom? And there was a lot of shoegazing and shuffling back and forth. And at the end of the day, they squandered it on other things because everything is happening at either a school or a district level and not at a, you know, city state level.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And in that solution, it's almost like you need something that's more structured holistically, right? Because anytime we're dealing with scale, I mean, if you want to do a technology project, even for your house, I mean, it can be complex depending on what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and at that level, it's like, okay, this is what we need per classroom. This is the model. This is the method. It's tested. It's proven. Now let's go replicate that in all the classrooms, right? That makes sense.
And even beyond that, I have a connection with Maine. I have a lot of family in Maine.
Right, right.
And I'm quite sure that a lot of people in Wisconsin are in the same situation, where in Maine, if you're in one of the major urban centers, say around Portland or Lewiston or what have you, yeah, piece of cake. Get broadband. You have multiple providers.
Right.
Multiple price points, you're good. Well, if you just go 25, 30 miles outside of these urban centers, not necessarily the case. You're lucky if you have broadband. It's going to be a lot more expensive. I was shocked when I saw what these people were paying for pretty poor service.
Yep.
Than, you know, what's available in the urban areas. And Maine is a big, big state. Wisconsin, big state, right?
Right.
So, you know, you get out to parts of both these areas and, you know, you can extrapolate to other parts of the United States. It's the same situation where a lot of people far apart, no broadband. In fairness, part of the CARES Act money was there to upgrade the broadband and all that. What happened? No activity, right? So here you could have parlayed a once in a lifetime opportunity to light up rural areas with real broadband access, right? Not satellite and the nonsense that they say is broadband, which we both know in fact isn't. And you would have done a great deal to service the broadest segment of your populace that you could, because now you have special needs kids, right? Okay, maybe they're functional enough where they can sit in front of device and have remote learning, right?
Right.
Is it optimal? No, but it still gives them something. And in the case where they can't do it, okay, pandemic threw a monkey wrench into traditional special ed processes and all that.
Yes.
Terrible. But again, it's one of those things where it's happened once. We've had a pandemic in modern times. It'll happen again. Well, what are we going to do to address the most marginalized and the most vulnerable of the population? Still haven't seen anything. And I understand the argument. All right, hey, we have to worry about getting everybody back to school. It's a huge hurdle. I got it. I agree with it totally. But why are we not starting to see comprehensive discussions about this? Instead, we're arguing back and forth about whether or not kids need to wear masks in the classroom. Do you open the window and all this other nonsense, right? We're past that. Those days are done. We're now on the rebuild phase. We have to reassess and start planning for the future so that if and when this happens again, it doesn't have the devastating impact. We have kids who have lost years of development, right? Well, what are you guys going to do about it? And there hasn't been any widespread discussion of core infrastructure stuff or the real other alternatives that are on the internet is free resources that could be brought in to help people with this, you know, Khan Academy or what have you, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why is that not part of a standard curriculum, right?
And internet-based learning. And by all means, I mean, if you have people, teachers, professors, et cetera, that are able to create excellent content.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I mean, like, top notch, because like, and then there's always a distribution. It doesn't matter. Statistically, there's always a distribution. And if we can get a lot of kids access to things, then I'm talking about learning material. I'm talking about courses. I'm talking about all the stuff that the internet can provide. This is like one of the greatest things that we can do in a connected era. Instead of being the disinformation age, let's pull ourselves back to the information age. Let's use it for the betterment of children and ultimately for the entire society. I mean, it has to happen. It should happen. And it's silly that we have to have this conversation right now, frankly.
Agreed. And this is where I think we have to lose this 19th century mindset, right?
Yes.
Of kids going to a building in a room with a teacher every day, all day, to have something drilled into them by rote learning, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, I understand I'll get a lot of flack for that statement, and it's an oversimplification, but I make it as an illustrative point for, you know, hey, why does it have to be that way? It doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Is there benefit to it? Yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. With a skilled educational professional, with a good curriculum, with engaged kids, a lot can happen. A lot of good can happen when you're in a classroom exchanging ideas back and forth. You know, for the little kids, all right, this isn't necessarily appropriate. The old way may be the better approach.
I think on that specifically is this social interaction, you know, in early ages, you know, age 2 to 4 or 5, even. I mean, you're learning your role, like how to interact with people, other people. I mean, it's critical. You have to have that.
Yeah. Absolutely true. Especially when we start talking about special ed kids and, you know, trying to mainline them as has been the approach for so long. A lot of benefit to that. Yeah. I think where I bring a disagreement to it is when you start talking about the older kids, middle school, high school, and beyond.
Yeah,
definitely a lot of value to classroom interaction. But is that the be-all, end-all of it? And, you know, why not find world leaders in particular fields, especially, you know, academics, right? I mean, for people in the professional field, this isn't viable. But academics love to talk about their work. They love to lecture. It's part of what being an academic is.
Yes.
And the ability to do it through platforms, Khan Academy, the EduX thing, or whatever. I mean, that's phenomenal, right?
Sure.
And could you approach these people and have them lecture a class? Maybe, right? It's easy enough. Look what we're doing with Zoom, and we're, you know, 1,500 miles apart right now, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There's no reason why they couldn't. There's no reason why there couldn't be an engaging method of learning, even if it were done for, you know, 10,000 students across 15 states. You know, we can make it happen, obviously. I mean, you go to colleges and you take classes where there's 400 or 500 people in the class. Like, you go to an auditorium to take the class. I mean, okay, am I still getting the information? Do I get the knowledge? Yes, I do. Now, the learning mechanisms, I mean, identifying, and I think this is another failure of the school system, and I'm sure you and I will talk about this. It's like identifying the fact that there are different ways to learn, and that different individuals process information differently. And that, you know, it's the round hole and the square peg, but the square peg is the size of a car and the round hole is the size of a Coke can, right? Like, you know, they don't mesh. Okay. But that doesn't mean that it's wrong. Right. So.
Everybody is unique in their personality, their particular gifts. Yeah. They're all going to learn different. Right.
Yes.
So this is an accepted fact. I don't think any rational person is going to dispute that. So if that's the case, why do we cookie cutter education for all of the kids the same way at the same time, right? As long as they cover the same material and understand it appropriately.
Yes.
You know, hey, maybe, you know, little Johnny needs to be in there with the teacher explaining it to him and asking a lot of questions, because that's the way little Johnny learns. That's fine.
Exactly. And maybe instead of carving up classes, you know, in some random distribution, it's like, you know, to the 60th percentile, these kids learn hands-on, right? Visually. So put them in these two classrooms and these two teachers can take care of it.
Because the teachers are specialized to understand that and to teach them in a most effective manner, right?
Yes.
I think this is what's missing on a lot of things. And I think it also ends up adding a lot of undue stress on teachers, because we know these
specialists. Absolutely. I know that does for a fact. I know it does. I've talked to many. Yes.
Right. So, you know, these people are out there, they're professionals, they've dedicated years to learning this. Why don't we carve it up and specialize so that their particular talents are applied to the group that will benefit the most?
That's the key word. That's apply. Why are we not applying it in a manner? And to me, this, it's a failure of everyone here. Everyone that's not a child that is above college age. It is all on us to make it better. It's not up to the children to tell us that they're unable to learn, or that we, you know, as a society, as we advance technologically, as we advance our understanding of the human mind and the capacity to learn, why aren't we taking that and bringing it out in a way that's consumable, that have specialized individuals, resources, to your point, that have been trained, you know, on all types of cognitive things, especially, you know, in this case, particularly to learning mechanisms,
right?
And identifying that, are we damned if we go and try to identify that the way that children learn based on, I don't know, like millions and millions of children that we've probably processed and analyzed? I mean, how long does it take you to figure out the best way that you learn something? I mean, it took me.
Well, okay. Time. Now, yeah.
Now, it's easy, but when you're young, Peter, right?
Yes. Yes. Understood.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what might be lacking. All right. There's an overemphasis on standardized testing. I'm sorry. It has a place.
Yes.
But later, right? Mm-hmm. What is not emphasized enough is teaching children at all levels how to think so that young kids can learn the fundamentals of logic, procedure, et cetera, et cetera. Right.
Yeah, sure.
You know, how do you get to three? Well, you add 1 + 1 + 1 and you get to 3, so on. Right.
Right.
Take the tried and true methodology, instill the core of teaching kids how to learn at an early age, and then they'll be able to develop their own particular learning style as they mature. I think there's not enough of this. There's too much focus on a one size fits all approach.
It's one size fits all because the measure of accountability at the school level is to take this exam and X percentage of your children have to pass that exam. And it's like, you just bash it into their heads. Right. But it's everything that I've always treated this in life. It doesn't matter if I'm learning something, which I try to do. I learn stuff all the time. It's just how my mind works. But it's like, if it's not what I'm learning that satisfies me, it's that I know how to learn and that I'm applying it in a meaningful way, that I'm getting better at something. Right.
Right.
So, and I think that's to your point, that's a little bit what's lost. It's not that 2 + 2 = 4. It's that any combination of numbers in any way, shape or form can equal 4. And it's, how are you going to solve that problem?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And again, the teaching of a methodology and an approach to solve, right. What I found interesting is that when I was in school, we had, again, we're talking junior, senior year of high school, right? There was a lot of effort paid, since we were on a college preparatory path, of, hey, you're going to have to take a lot of standardized tests going forward, meaning SAT immediately, but down the line, licensing exams for accounting or what have you. There's a million professions out there that require it.
Yeah.
Hey, there's a way to take these tests to maximize your chances. Really? I didn't know this. Tell me how. And we worked through, you know, the fundamentals, you know, multiple choice, you eliminate the obvious errors, and then you try and figure out what's left on the others. You go from a 1 in 4 chance down to a 1 in 2 chance, right? Okay, great. That's a way to learn and a way to solve a particular problem in terms of standardized testing. I've asked both my kids, they didn't do that, right? I had to pay for extra course, even with private school, to have them learn how to take SATs and later professional licensure exams, right? I think this is the sort of thing that has to get addressed, because people want to talk a lot about inequity in education. And I don't believe that necessarily there is an inherent inequity in education. I believe there's an inequity in the quality of the instruction in education through various factors. And part of it is along this, right? You take the kids through school, you give them all this knowledge, some of it useless, some of it quite useful, but then you never teach these kids from the beginning how this affects reality, right? How does this matter to you in the real world? And even I was talking to my daughter, she's in college, right? I said, hey, you know, do they cover any financial classes with you guys? And she's like, nope, not unless you're a business major. So they're telling you, go ahead, get loans, incur perpetual debt, and no idea if you're ever going to pay it off. She's like, yeah, basically. Well, you know, clearly I've had these kinds of discussions with both my kids at an early age. But I was not amazed, I would say disappointed, that given the way society's progressed, given what a hot button issue student loan debt is at the collegiate level.
Economics in general. Yeah.
Right. Right. Nobody has talked to them. Right. And I dug into it a little bit. I think maybe this is a discussion for another show, but you know, financial literacy 101, right? What are we not prepping our kids for? And why is everybody struggling so much, right? Again, the core is 19th century education for a 21st century world, and not prepping anybody at any level of it for the variety of circumstances that you're going to encounter and what it really means, right? What's garbage? What's gold? How do you have the kids differentiate between it in the real world, not the academic world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. How do you use it? It's like, I'm teaching you math. Here's some practical examples. And I'm not talking about, here's a math word problem that maybe helps me measure your executive like functioning skills as you interpret the modes and means of that paragraph and translate it into something meaningful, i.e. the answer that the teacher needs or expects. But you know, you might be one day sitting at the store and you might say, well, I hand this guy a $10 bill because I wanted a box of cookies, and the box of cookies was $8.88. So now I know immediately in my head, I need $1.22 back, and I'd probably give it to him as a tip anyway. Right. But you know, just for the sake of the argument, you know, I need that. Or it's like, I need to buy a car because, well, I need to get to work now that I have a job. And I can buy this car and you know, maybe I can get 4% from the credit union. And I don't even know what that means, because the dealership says I can walk out of here today with zero down if I sign here. You know, truth be told, you're paying 8.5% on that one or whatever it may be. And without understanding how compound interest works, you don't understand the total debt and what your cost per month is. Or factored on top of that, that, oh, now I have to pay insurance. And I'm going to have gas, and I'm going to, so I have this concept of total cost of ownership,
right?
Right. And there's, I can actually break that down into a cost per mile essentially that's driven. And if I'm not allocating that in some way, or my income isn't greater than a certain threshold, I'm going to have financial problems.
Right. We all want the Ferrari. All want the Ferrari, but there's a reason Toyota is number one in America, right?
100%. Yeah. Toyota was very popular. Yeah. I might even buy a Corolla. I'm not even joking, man.
This is a show topic in its own. So
it is. And I just wanted, again, the first show, I just kind of wanted to touch on it because it's the lack of common skill knowledge in the translation, because there's plenty of things that I've read and I think very abstractly, right? And I can read it and I can sit there and think about it and I can pull information out of it. And I can come back and think about it some more, like while I'm walking in the backyard a week from now, right? And then I'll be like, I'll probably connect the dots, probably. Yeah. What I found in life is that isn't typically the case for the average person. And if those of us who know can convey what those concepts are and how they relate, then I think we're, you know, at least in my eyes, trying to leave the world a better place. And that just comes from the basic understanding of how things work in the observed
world. Which I think ultimately is the goal of education, and which gets lost in so much of the senseless rhetoric and bickering that goes around with it.
Yes.
Right? The whole purpose, as stated from the beginning, is to create the virtuous man, to, you know, take the ancient philosopher's phrase of it, right?
Right.
So, okay, now we want the virtuous man in 21st century or woman, right?
Absolutely.
Well, how do you do that? Quality education at all levels that isn't politicized and that doesn't assume mediocrity. We need to instill excellence in the kids. And if we do that, we have a winning society at all levels.
Yeah, I can't agree with you anymore on that statement. I mean, it's not about, as you're stating here, it's not about lowering the bar for everyone so that everybody crosses the line. It's about keeping a bar high, because without something to aim at, right? What are we going to hit? The ground. And in this case, I don't want to hit the ground. I want to hit the target, right?
Right.
And I mean, it's kind of, You're of Greek heritage, right? And there's a lot of great philosophical works in Greek history, and some of my favorite books actually are written from 2,500 years ago. and it makes me laugh, really. And in my head, not in a ha-ha funny way, but it's like, how much is there to gain from the knowledge of past societies, from the knowledge of past brilliance that we cannot even take and consume here and apply to I read a book like The Republic, right? And it just captures verbatim the state that we sit in right now.
Yeah.
And you don't even have to think too abstractly to see it. I was baffled the first time I read that. I was like, wow, here we are. And I kind of think back to it, you know?
I think that says something pretty profound though, right? Yes. Where 2,500 years, and you know, you can take other examples as well, right? Rome, Egypt, what have you, right? Human nature has not changed since we first formed any kind of society, right?
Correct.
You go to uncontacted tribes in the middle of the jungle on New Guinea, South America, what have you. Mm-hmm. They still have family structures. They still have societal customs. They still have societal expectations that need to be transmitted. Mm-hmm. And everybody wants to be the best within that society, right? So if it's so universal, clearly it's an inherent part of what it means to be human.
It absolutely is.
And if that's the case, then strip all this technology aside and everything else and start teaching the kids how to be excellent. And that there is a methodology that, you know, life essentially is a game with rules. You need to learn those rules so that you can play the game and hopefully win it. And if you don't win it, at least you don't lose it. And this is, I think, something that needs to be emphasized a lot more than it has been.
It has to be. And I think life is it's a blank canvas for us all.
Yeah.
To go and do something perhaps meaningful, to do something that, you know, I think every single person that lives, that is a conscious being, has something in them. When you look at something, when you're drawn to something, you're drawn to some subject, you're drawn to certain things. Do you even consciously choose that? Right? Like, did I wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a computer guy for all intents and purposes? Or was no, I just
like the money?
I wish I was, you know, it just happened that way. Right. Yeah. But I mean, I was like 7 or 8 years old and I was like, look at this huge book that my mother has for COBOL programming. And I'm like, start reading it. And next thing you know, I'm writing software on her computer. You know, and okay, that's not the story for everybody. But the point that I'm making there is that I was drawn to it.
Yeah.
Why was I drawn to it? You know, why? And when I look at something, I don't try to be like the worst at something. And I'm sure you don't either. And many of the people that we know don't. Like, right. we have to drive towards excellence. I think part of it fundamentally, and again, probably a topic for another show, because I could get into the psychology of this all day long, but it's that the main emphasis here is that if we don't strive towards excellence, okay, we are destined to die. And I'm talking that as a society. Yeah. If you touched on it. If our other societies that we can observe, even uncontacted societies, they have social hierarchies, they have dominance hierarchies, they work within them, they fill roles, they want to achieve excellence, they have to achieve excellence, because if they don't, they don't eat. Right. We've been kind of like surrounded by luxury. I call it like luxury beliefs almost, because we get to, as Americans, we get to view the world. Some of us get to view the world through a certain, like, you know, tinted glass here. And it takes the reality away from the situation that, we have to work. And if we don't work and we don't try to get better, that someone else in the world is going to do that, because now we're a global economy. It's not just the economy of Wisconsin and Massachusetts or the United States, right? We're all competing.
Right.
Exactly. We're playing this game, and whether or not you want to admit that you're playing it or not, you're playing it. You know, so if you don't want to get better at the game that you're playing, which is, you know, being a member of society in the 21st century, then I don't know what you're doing. But we certainly want to help you.
And I think on that note, we have an hour. Maybe we bring this show to a conclusion and take up a new topic next time.
Absolutely. I think part of what I'd like to do in this series, in the continuing episode, is we certainly have a lot more to discuss on the education system, and we're certainly looking for feedback from our viewers as far as, you know, other content that we'd like to see. And we'll be sharing that subsequently. So thank you all for listening. Peter, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Daniel. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, you as well. Talk to you soon.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Subscribe now to be notified of future episodes and check out our website at theallunknowing.com.